Good morning. Open the Senate Revenue Committee. Here is the order that we will go in. Sorry for the 9 o'clock starts. This is the order that we'll go in today. We're going to work a couple bills, committee, if we're ready to go on. First on urban renewal, so we'll do that one first. And there really is just two options there. One is, as you will remember, and Senator Starr, I might let you help present these since you were on the work group. But I believe we have, just two amendments before us. One is encapsulating the work group's activity plus. Well, Mary, do you want to talk about the two amendments that we have before us? And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 412.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 412, version 2, or amendment version 2. Adds increasing the duration of the plan to the types of future amendments that are substantial amendments which would require a notice, hearing, and approval procedure required on the original plan. This is in addition to the original amended version 1, which also basically proposed that whenever an urban renewal plan is created or substantially changed, the local governing body must issue a public notice and invite local taxing districts to a public hearing. It also proposes that as an urban renewal governing authority, that authority be allowed to certify less than the maximum amount calculated by division of tax for the purpose of financing its urban renewal plans. This option will pertain to any new urban renewal plan for any urban renewal plan that is substantially changed after the effective date of the bill. As we met last a few days ago, the committee met to discuss version 1, and at that time the work group asked to add this additional amendment which dealt with the duration of the plan, so that if the plan were to change the duration of the funding or how long the plan was to exist, that would be considered a substantial change that would require the public hearing that's being proposed and the notification and the involvement of the taxing districts. We were also asked at the time, the committee asked us also, can I go on to version 3?
Yes, so the dash 3, mm-hmm. So that's the dash 2s.
That's the dash 2. The dash 3 is everything that the dash 2 has, with the additional provision that the Urban Renewal Governing Authority would be able to consider excluding a taxing district or a special taxing district described in ORS 198.010 from participation in the Urban Renewal Plan. These amendments apply to urban renewal plans that are created or substantially amended after the effective date of this act. Those are the two amendments, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mary. So really what we have, the choice we have before us is the dash 3s would add, everything in the dash 2s were the consensus. The dash 3s would add that permissive opt-out to give that urban renewal agency or grantor the ability to opt out, opt police, fire, or schools if they so chose out.
Mr. Chair, that would be at the head. The opt-out would take place at the decision point of the urban renewal proposal.
I believe it's written it would be, or if it were substantially changed.
Or substantially changed.
Senator Brzezinski or Senator Starr?
I think that the dash threes really reflect my desired change, and that it would allow an opt-out does not in any way mandate it, and that it would be possible at the beginning of the plan or when substantially changed. What I'm not clear on is whether that includes extension of the plan as a major change. My desire was that if they extended the plan, that it would be a major change.
Correct, because the version 2 adds the duration of the plan, which is the extension of the plan, to the definition of a substantial change, Senator Starr. So it would fall into place then with version 3 that if anything changed, that was a substantial change, which includes changing the boundaries, changing the maximum indebtedness, or if, as proposed, changing the duration of the plan, then it would trigger the involvement of, you know, the public hearing process.
I like it. I like the Dash 3 amendment.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this is, I think, what we heard from the last work group as to the desire. The only thing we need to put on the record, what we need to make certain is that the bonding, I want to say the bonders, have to be in the loop as to when these decisions are made. We talked about whether there should be the ability to opt out on at multiple different phases, but clearly at the very beginning, that is when you're taking your package for bonding, and the bonders are going to know what the makeup is, and they'll be able to set the rate based on all those calculations, knowing who is or who isn't in there. And clearly, once that's been set, and you can't just basically change out or modify that plan without having some buy-in by the bonders, because they've established rates for the bonds themselves, and it would be, I think we would be putting urban renewal, even just having the potential of that coming, could really have an impact on actually getting bonds issued if there wasn't any certainty there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure, you know, it sounds like we've got everything covered in the Dash 3s. As we pass this out, if we find that it needs to be tightened up, I know it can be done on the House side, and we'll need to make certain that happens. But that's the only reservation I have, is that making sure that if there's a change in the plan, it's got to be one that would require the bonders buy-off or, before you could actually let a service district out, even permissibly, because I think you've changed the rules and the certainty of the repayment. Mm-hmm. But besides that, I think the Dash 3s capture everything that we did in our work group, and as Senator Stark says, I like it.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a decision a local governing body is going to look at and consider whether or not there are those kind of implications before they would be affirmative to letting anyone drop out as part of the one of the units.
And they should be conscious of, just your point, Senator Brzezinski, of in terms of protecting the certainty of that bond. I would think the agency that's actually issuing and talking to the bond council is going to, they're going to want to have all the certainty in the world so that they get the best financial arrangement they possibly can. Senator Metzger?
I like it. I'm ready to move it.
Okay, we got five for the Dash 3s. Senator Stark.
Yes. Chair Deckard, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 412.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 412. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? So ordered, Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 412 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 412 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Thank you to Senator Brzezinski and Senator Starr for heading up that work group. I know you worked really hard with a lot of interested parties who are in the audience. So thank you for your hard work. And if you'd be willing to carry it together, you made a good team on this.
Sure.
We'll have co-carriers.
Actually, we need to probably get Mary to carry it for us. She's the one to carry the
bill. She'll carry you, and you'll carry the bill.
That's true. You know, when you do co-carriers, Mary's going to have to, we'll have her moving on the Senate floor, because she'll have to staff both, and they don't sit next to each other, so you'll get your exercise on the floor.
She'll be nimble.
That's right. Great, thank you. Closed work session on Senate Bill 412. Open a work session on Senate Bill 470, and as Paul gets situated for 470, the order that we'll do this in is we'll do Senate Bill 853 after we do this, and then we'll do the reserve funds following that. Mr. Warner.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 470 establishes a statutory spending limit, and discussed this at a previous meeting on March 14th. And you had the sponsors, Senators Morse and Schrader, here, and described it as an effort to put in statute some of the things that the budget process is undergoing now. So that was the intent. The one issue that came up with the discussion was a way to make a reserve fund or ending balance more prominent in the bill, even though it's mentioned in section 3, for example, on page 3, the amount and availability of monies in the Education Stability Fund and other reserve accounts is listed as a factor that should be considered by both the governor and the legislature when they set the limit. But the committee discussion was trying to raise the prominence of that, and so I did have an amendment drawn up that would do that. Council recommended that the amendment refer to a reasonable and prudent ending balance, given the fact that we don't technically have a reserve fund right now, so other than the Education Stability Fund, which is mentioned. So the suggestion is to move up on the first page a new section B that would refer to one of the factors that should be considered, as obviously the general fund revenues projections and lottery revenue projections is under A, and then under a new B would be the need for a reasonable and prudent ending balance, and then the old B would be moved down to C, listing some of the other factors that the governor and legislature would consider. So that would be the dash one amendments to the bill. There is a blank, which I don't have an amendment on, under on page 2, line 11, refers to the maximum amount as a percentage of the general fund, what could be put in the emergency fund. Mm-hmm. So that's to prevent a very large emergency fund that would be outside the limit. So that's still a blank at this point. That would be up to committee if you want to put something in. That 1%, for example, would be roughly $100 million.
Mm-hmm. Senator Starr, does the dash one accomplish the goal you set out in terms of getting some reserve fund language or ending balance language in there?
Yes, it does.
What I'd like to do on this is, this doesn't have a referral to Ways and Means, but in talking to the co-chairs, they'd like to have this bill, and so I'd like to, if we're going to move it, to adopt the dash ones and then just move it to Ways and Means and let them fill in that blank and decide, make further decisions on, but they wanted to take a look at any spending limit language that we enacted.
That's appropriate. Chair Deckard.
Senator Starr.
Move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 470.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 470. Discussion.
I can do the amendment. I still like the bill.
Any objections to that amendment? So ordered. Senator Starr.
At the chair's direction, I will move Senate Bill 470 as amended to Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 470 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I appreciate the efforts on this, I'm not supportive of the bill. I don't like some of the policy things and wouldn't want to be voting in support of those. I'm particularly concerned, Section 1, first page, beginning in lines 29, 30, and the second page. And what it basically says is if you don't have a budget bill that has been passed and signed, that no other bills after such a date could be enacted. And I mean, this is a situation where someone, an individual or a group or a group of folks passed us because I know we play together well, but others who wouldn't could actually totally stop the legislative process because they didn't like something in the budget,
mm-hmm.
which would not, I think, be a good thing for Oregonians to have a legislative mandated impasse. It's almost like a, it's almost like setting a strike date in legislation, and that doesn't work well in public contracting. Sometimes for public services, I think it would be poor for the legislature. I'm also just have questions, and Paul, maybe you could help on this one. On page 2, lines 6 and 7, where it says they may not recommend bills that in total appropriate or allocate more of the amount allowed for each purpose specified in a subsection of this section. And I'm curious, especially the word appropriate, and that is that we do a lot of bonding in this committee and in this legislature. So we can allocate monies to pay indebtedness, but then we appropriate a very large amount. For example, the highway bill, we allocated $100 million a year out into taxes, but we appropriated $2.5 billion. And I'm curious as to would that language cover the $2.5 billion or the $100 billion under the spending limitation, and based on both words, allocation and appropriation. Because it would really severely limit your ability to bond if that was counted against the spending limitation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you could offer an interpretation of that.
Senator Metzger, I think the answer to that is that the bill is focused on general fund and lottery. Lottery is referred to as allocating rather than appropriating, and that's why that language is there. But the appropriations from the general fund would include, if there are lottery proceeds that are in the budget, that would be included as an appropriation for that biennium. It would not include, for example, the total amount that's a bonding authority that would stretch beyond the current biennium. So I think it's consistent with the language that we have now in terms of the general fund budget that you're familiar with, and the fact that it's not continuously appropriated, that it's within the expenditure limits established in the general fund. So it would have to meet those criteria that we have to balance to under current law. We have to balance to the revenue projection.
Yeah, I still am not sure whether that would be subject to different individuals' interpretations of what a given legislative assembly is spending on that particular year. I would like to maybe have an opportunity to talk to legislative council about that interpretation.
Okay. Senator, we have talked extensively with Joan Robinson and council about this issue, and whenever we've had spending limits, and there is some ambiguity in terms particularly of what is general fund, because we do have a series of funds that we call general fund in the statutes that we don't consider general fund for budgetary purposes. So there is some ambiguity there in terms of the statutory references to general fund versus, you know, what you see in your revenue forecast.
Mr. Chair, because I and I think maybe a more contemporary issue. For example, we just moved yesterday in transportation the Connect Oregon bill, which is $100 million for, you know, freight mobility and other services. And you know, if that makes it through the legislative process, you know, we will be allocating, you know, roughly $8 or $9 million. For the debt service on that particular bill, but we will be expending $100 million, appropriating $100 million, and I just think that should be clarified a bit more, lest a future legislature find they were bound in the language of a bill that was not intended.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just my two concerns.
No, they're very. Sure. No, that's partly the reason why I want to actually refer this to Ways and Means, because I wasn't completely sold. I saw the value and talked to Senator Morse a great deal about this, but your words of a legislatively mandated train wreck are the concern that I have too of 10, 15 years by having that date in statute. I could just see future problems for future legislatures. So the agreement I have with the sponsor and with Senator Schrader and the other co-chair is that we'll continue to talk about whether we want to actually put this bill on the floor of the Senate and the House. But it does seem like an intriguing enough concept that I'd like to move it out, although I think objections are not a completely bad idea to have those marked.
I'm afraid I would have to vote no on the language as proposed.
Understand.
I moved it to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Senator Starr has moved the bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
With a due pass or just no recommendation?
With a due pass.
So Senator Starr is going to make it interesting here with a due pass recommendation. Further, Senator Brzezinski, you missed a little bit of the conversation, Senator Metzger.
I did. Two senators made me go outside, you know. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I guess the question is it necessary for us to do pass on it as compared to getting it to the next arena, allowing the people that are going to make the dollar decisions, that decision, whether it one should even come out. And so I guess I'd be more comfortable just sending it down to them, knowing that there's not consensus here, and letting them have that next shot at it.
I can go either way. I've talked to
they're going to vet it.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to the folks down there. This is a 60-40 one for me, but if we wanted to have two no votes on it, that's maybe not a bad sign that this is something we wanted to take a look. I know we have one no vote, Senator George. I'm assuming you're good to go.
Can I ask Paul a question, though?
Sure, please.
Paul, is there anything in this piece of legislation right here that we're proposing? It couldn't be overridden by the next legislative assembly saying, nope, don't like that part. This is what we plan to do, and we're going to go ahead and put a note in there exempting it from this. Mm-hmm.
Senator George, this would be a fully statutory measure. I would suspect that a future legislature would probably look at some of these definitions and would find some areas where they'd need to clarify it.
Well, if we don't find that happening in Ways and Means already, so I agree. And I think that split vote on this issue coming out of this committee is going to give plenty of heads up to Ways and Means that they need to look closely.
I agree with that. Anything further, questions or comments? Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, I guess one question is for Paul. When we look under subsection 1 of section 1 on the first page, where it does have the list of areas that they're supposed to be considering, is that actually ranked in any priority?
No.
Education, public safety, human services, or is that just based on the percentage of the general fund that they currently take?
There's nothing explicit, Senator Brzezinski, in there about the ranking that I see. You know, I think it's just a listing of the major program areas, the major elements of the budget decisions that have to be made. They're not in terms of size either. Human services would be larger than public safety,
right,
in terms of the percentage of the budget. So I think they're just a listing of the items that have to be looked at, and that you have the subcategories of the budget where you have to assign a value, a top-down value before the budget work begins.
Now, we could put all of our favorite programs in at a G, H, and I, and just I'll put Onami on there and a couple other programs. And
that would make them think, huh?
That's true. That would be a real curveball for
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator
I think
George.
We just exposed the purpose for the bill.
Not a fair point. Anything further, Senator Brzezinski? Barbara, can you call the roll on Senator Starr's due pass recommendation to Ways and Means, not the floor, on Senate Bill 470?
Aye. Senator Metzger.
No.
Senator Brzezinski.
Oh, why not?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
Aye.
Chair Deckard.
Votes aye. So the motion passes. We got our first no votes on the committee, and they came from a Democrat. That might be a good sign for us. And that bill will go down to Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 853, which Paul, are you...
I'm the lucky one.
You're the lucky. You got the short straw on 853.
That's right. Mr. Chair, you have in your packet material from the work group. And I just have a very brief outlines for the beginnings of staff measure summary. And you have the material before you from Senator Morse and the work group. Basically what the bill does is authorize the state universities to set up the venture development funds. And it does establish a tax credit for contributors to those funds. The bill sets the credit at 60% of the amount contributed with a $50,000 cap. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I know you all have worked very hard on this proposal. Please introduce it to us and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis. This bill is somewhat unique in that it does draw together the major components of a university to focus on how do we effectively commercialize the concepts, the inventions, and the technologies that come out of our universities. In that, it brings to play the foundations in fundraising. It brings into play the schools of business and entrepreneurial education. And it brings into play the research parts of our universities. The fund creates a cap for OHSU in the amount of $4 million, a cap for the Oregon University systems of $10 million, and those allocations respectively would be determined by rule within each of those institutions, the Oregon University System and Oregon Health Sciences University. The fund is one that's created by donations, and the intent of the funds, and they would be plural because each university would have the ability to create its own fund that could reside either within the foundation or within some other branch of the university. The intent of the funds is for making grants to the earliest phase of the commercialization, which is called in many circles the Valley of Death, proof of concept, so that these concepts, they're seeds, and this is the first stage of watering the seeds of commercializations out of our universities. And I think as the testimony unfolds here this morning, hopefully you'll grasp the importance of this first phase of funding and the gap that we have in current funds available today to jumpstart this. It was interesting in talking to Oregon State University yesterday, 71% of the patents that have been issued to Oregon State University are commercialized. This fund would provide, and finding funding for the very expensive issue of securing patents, it's expensive. This fund could make grants to secure those patents. So the idea is that these funds, it's multiple funds specific to each university, would be available for that proof of concept. What we added to this was a tax credit recapture component, so that what we're doing is a matter of public policy. We're advancing funds for commercialization, and then as that commercialization occurs and the income stream then comes back to the universities through licensing and through technology, that the way the bill reads today is that 20% of that income stream would come back to the state treasury, so that you're recapturing the money that we're advancing through the tax credit. And so over time, not only do you recapture the investment that we have made but you have multiple returns on that investment. This fund is really a function of our faith in our universities. Can they produce inventions and technologies that can be commercialized, developed within our state, and produce jobs, tax revenue, and expand our economy? That's really the fundamental question, is do we have faith? And if we do have faith in that, then I would suggest that this bill is very efficacious in terms of advancing and accelerating the commercialization of technology in our universities. So with that opening statement, we do have folks that are here to testify on this. Those that would be affected would use these funds and would like to progress, Mr. Chairman, through this testimony this morning, because I think you'll find it very, very helpful. I would like to publicly acknowledge the work that Pat Scruggs has done on this. It's been tremendous in helping to pull together all of the components and the players in this theme and to focus our energies on this bill. So with that, I will turn to Pat Scruggs.
Thank you, Chair Deckert and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Pat Scruggs, and I am the Innovation and Technology Manager at Oregon Economic and Community Development. I think Senator Morris gave a good introduction to the bill. What I wanted to do very briefly, because we have people here who have the expertise in these areas much greater than I, to talk just a little bit and make some key points about this bill. First of all, one of the things that I do is I also staff the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development. And for the 4 years that that council has been in operations, we might say, that they have identified really three really key points. And that was, we need good entrepreneurial talent here at the startup stages for our businesses. And we need to be able to commercialize our research at a rate that much faster than what we're doing. And also then with that, we need to leverage that commercialization of university research into broader and more venture capital for business startups here in Oregon. And in my testimony, I've provided you on written testimony on the second page. There is a chart that the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development uses. It's this nice little colorful thing that we have. But one of the things I wanted to point out was this fund is very intentional in where it fills a gap that we have. It's not just saying, oh, this is really good. The last couple of sessions, the Assembly here has passed some legislation like the Oregon Investment Fund, the $100 million for new venture development in Oregon. Well, those great ideas, those venture-ready ideas have to come from somewhere if we're going to keep that money here in Oregon. And so one of the things that this does is hit that gap and be able to leverage things that we have done in the past very effectively. So this is where we had basically a hole in the chain, so to speak, a gap, a link missing. And we're trying to fill a link that would help investments like we've made in Onami and other growing research universities and the other end of the VC money and put it together. That's primarily what we're trying to do here. I also attached in my written testimony a letter from EGI. They do dense array EEG products, basically brain stuff, I guess.
The
things that we just have no clue. Yeah, the things for the brain. But one of the things that Ann Bunnenberg, who is their president, says in this letter is that they didn't have this type of fund, and because of that, it took them years more, 12 months more to develop, 18 months more to get things to market, and their employee growth was stunted because of that. And they had to go through basically 2 years of getting piecemeal grants through the federal government to do this kind of thing. And she talks about the importance of the acceleration at this stage and what it could have done. These are real examples. She went from nothing to 40 employees to $12 million in revenue to an additional $12 million in federal research from a very small amount of money up front. This is the living example of what we're trying to do. So with those two things, I just wanted to try to set the stage for what you hear about in a moment. And then finally, the one thing that we have tried to do is to understand what other economic impact we would have from this fund and direct impact in terms of income tax, job creation, et cetera. And so John Gorarulu, who is the economist at Oregon Economic Development, will take you through very quickly what we have in the spreadsheet to try to set the stage for saying that not only would we recapture the money through license revenues back to the university, but there are real direct economic impacts to the state, and we didn't count any of the indirect, the capital expenditures, construction jobs, any of those other, as my grandmother used to call, fancy math stuff in these things. So this is purely direct direct economic benefit we think is associated with this fund.
Pat, before we do that, we've kind of set a high bar for tax credits, and that, especially new ones, and so I guess the question is what evidence do we have that this tax credit that, as I, from my knowledge, is not replicated anywhere else, would actually work and achieve the desired result in Center Morse? I know you've worked really hard on this, but that's, I think, the first threshold question that I have is that it would actually get us and that Oregonians would employ this to help these seed companies expand and do their magic.
Chairman, if I may, there's about 12 other states that actually do offer a tax credit for mostly into VC funds, some into university-related VC funds. North Carolina is one of those, Maryland's one of those, et cetera. Most of those are an upfront tax credit into the fund. They range from 20 to 40%. Their caps are very much like this. Their caps are usually about $50,000. So the numbers we had here in terms of caps and percents actually do come from other working funds. What they don't do is they don't spread the tax credit over time like we have here to defer the impact on the state. What they do is a one-time upfront tax credit in other states. By the way, that has worked to raise significant amount of capital in these areas. And so if we take a look at the states that are using those and where they were employed, one of those being North Carolina in the Triangle area, another one being the fund out of Texas in the Austin area, there is direct correlation to the business growth in subsequent years from these funds.
Well, just the thought that I have, and I think of the Oregon Cultural Trust, which has been successful, but has a more intricate tax credit than what we're just standardly used to. And they've marketed it, and it hasn't actually been utilized to the extent that they originally thought. And this is with pretty decent marketing of trying to let Oregonians know we have this new cultural trust that is an attractive tax credit. So just in the back of my mind, I keep thinking really, and I guess the universities will address this and the foundations will, but you'd really have to market this heavily to, I guess, the foundations community to explain the benefits to folks of utilizing it.
Yeah.
Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Galaulu, the economist for Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. As Pat Skirk said, my role in this was basically to take a look at the possible economic development impacts of the fund if it got approved and implemented. Now, in most studies of economic development impacts, there's a variety of factors that are taken into account. The general practice is to look at the direct, indirect, and induced impacts. For our purposes, we limited ourselves to basically the direct impacts of the fund. That is, we didn't take into account downstream or upstream jobs that are likely to be created as a result of implementing this project. Our emphasis is really on three sources of impacts. The first is really the research jobs that are created as a result of funding commercialization activities. If you provide funding to the universities to support research projects, they're going to hire people, they're going to pay salaries. So the first impact we look at is basically the jobs that are directly associated with research jobs created as a result of supporting projects. And from our estimate, and based on assumptions used by the National Science Foundation that basically associates research funding at a universal level with jobs created, we came up with some numbers that basically give us some ideas about how much tax revenues we can expect to capture as a result of providing this funding to universities. So that's one impact we attempted to estimate. The second impact really has to do with the royalties that are created as a result of fostering the development of new technologies and new ideas that then become licensed, and then those licenses generate royalties. Now, that aspect of the estimation is a bit complicated because projects vary wildly, and there's a wide variation in terms of the payback period, in terms of how much license revenue you can generate per project. So in terms of estimating those impacts, we basically looked at scenarios. So, well, given the state of the world that we are assuming, given, say, a mild optimistic scenario in which few of the projects are able to generate licenses that are highly marketable, what would be the revenue impact on the state? So basically, it's a scenario analysis. The third aspect we looked at really has to do with the companies that are generally associated with these new ideas. Over the past several years, there's been a lot of reports of companies being developed as a result of new ideas coming to the marketplace. I mean, we all know the famous stories of the Microsofts and a few of the high-tech companies that are developing in Silicon Valley. So we also expect that there's a possibility that you could have potential economic impact as a result of this fund by allowing companies to be created or supporting the development of companies. So those three impacts, looking at them critically and also looking at these various scenarios, made us believe that the state stands to gain substantially from implementing this fund. And we estimate that there'll be an immediate impact once the fund is approved in terms of the research jobs, because it doesn't take a long time to get those going once the funds are available and projects get approved. The jobs get created in less than a year, I would say. So the impact is immediate. And I think the good thing about that is that the tax credit then become repayable in a relatively short period of time from the research jobs. In terms of the royalties, the scenario is such that if you assume an optimistic outlook, then within a matter of 10 years, at a 20% payback rate, that is 20% of the royalties that the universities are generating get paid back to the state, it would take about 10 years to pay back the total tax credit extended. Now, with respect to the companies that are coming online in terms of new companies that are able to attract venture capital as a result of receiving this funding, I also believe if we are fortunate, we have an optimistic situation, the payback period will even be shorter. Now, it is very important to emphasize here that this is a very conservative outlook on the economic impacts. Most studies basically look at the indirect and induced impacts in addition to the impacts we've discussed. So looking at all of the numbers, the scenarios seem to suggest that this is a project that the state could stand to substantially benefit from. And as a result of having a recapture rate aspect to the whole project, it's also possible to have direct liquidity flows to the state, not just in terms of personal income tax revenues.
Thank you very much. Paul, do you want to go economist to economist here? And Senator George, and please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think how far we've come, going back to 1999, I believe it was, and we moved a bill out. It was going to establish, I believe we appropriated $2 million that was to set up within the university system research with the donated time and technology by an entrepreneur who had retired in Oregon who was from the computer system. You probably are shaking your head knowing what we're talking about. And this was established the technologies for tracking and directing transit. And it was part of the Smart Jitney compact. That was probably the problem with the bill was the name. But the thing was interesting. The feds were extremely interested. We met with them. There's some federal transportation people. They thought, boy, if you develop this, this is something that we can move. I mean, we need this not only in the United States but worldwide. After this whole thing collapsed and the $2 million just faded into whatever the governor did with it, What happened? Because we didn't have the mechanism within the university to actually handle the accounts and to move this thing forward. The sad part of this whole story is that 2 years later, I believe it was, that TriMet ended up buying a tracking coordinating system that wouldn't do, it wasn't even close to what we believe could be done within, in other words, technology and programming developed here in Oregon. And I just sit and kind of smile when I think about, you know, this is such a giant step forward to be able to tie these whole things together where that research is being done at the university and then quickly moving it forward into the economy for development. And then here, like in this case, it was something that would have benefited transit throughout the world. And it should have been done here in Oregon. And I'm glad now that we're not going to make that mistake again. And I think your numbers are conservative when it comes to what the potential of some of these things is. That wasn't a question at all, was it?
It was a good speech. Sometimes we're like that. We like to espouse our particular proposals and link them to other CenterMetzer.
Thank you. If one of you could take a shot at this. Just help me understand, if this became law, you know, how the flow of money would work and the motivation behind it. So if I'm Frank Morris, Inc., and I have decided I would like to make a contribution to the University of Oregon's venture, I say that just because I know it's Oregon State, so I'm trying to be bipartisan with the universities here, to a venture fund that has been set up by the University of Oregon for research. So you have a motivation, but you're an investor, so you're giving them money. And they're giving that. Now, that goes into this fund, as I understand it. This fund then would distribute money to different recipients based on their proposals. So then, where's Frank's payback? How is that determined? Because it says in the language of the bill, an investor shall be allowed to get a tax credit. So I'm trying to, the language of the bill calls you an investor who makes this contribution. That's what it says. So tax credits for investors seeking to provide venture capital. So tell me how that plays out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, it's an excellent question. And in my marked up copy, if we're successful in moving this to a work session, that language needs to be changed because it was an oversight in the -1 and the -2 amendments to change that language on the first page from investors to donors. Because this is not an investor-driven program. And in response to the chair's question about could you actually create these funds, I think if we look at the history of foundations and fundraisings for these universities, and by the way, for the record, we have given to the University of Oregon, even though I'm an alum of Oregon State. So we are...
Such a...
We're bipartisan.
Side jab there.
If you look at the success of the foundations, you know, why do people give? It's because they believe in the institution and what the institution is doing. Albeit there are a variety of things, whether it be athletics or whether it be academics or buildings or the arts or, you know, whatever it is, people have a special motivation. And those foundations are successful. As your alma mater, Chair, has a very aggressive capital campaign underway, and it's successful. People will give to things they believe in, and this benefits the institution because of the commercialization and the licensing and royalty stream that comes back to build that university into even a bigger, better institution. So I think this tax credit would, and you need to hear this from the foundations, but I just have to believe that people, because of their interest in Oregon State or OHSU or Portland State or OIT or whatever it may be, whichever institution, that really is the motivation. The other key thing is that people that are in this business of raising money will tell you that once people start giving to something, they are much more prone to continue giving and to expand their giving. So you've got that, you know, the friends of the University of Oregon are broad and varied, and they love the institution. And will they do something for the institution that would help the state expand its economy and create jobs? I believe so. I just think that would happen.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And you're right. That's why when you do give to somebody, you never stop getting the pledge cards and phone calls the rest of your life because you have been identified. But thank you for clarifying that because I couldn't see how that juxtaposed to everything else here. So.
And we're going to have someone from the foundations and from the institutions talk about that very issue of how they would talk to prospective donors and utilize this new credit if we do it. Other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Frank, what would be wrong with the idea? I mean, a person really is investing in the university for this research and hoping that the university would commercialize some idea. What's wrong with the concept of me making an investment in that university and spinning off something that, in fact, all of us might be able to make some money off the university? And if I move on the commercial side of that and came backwards, I mean, all we care about is getting the ideas out and getting these jobs into Oregon. Do you see anything philosophically wrong with anybody actually profiting off of this? Because obviously the university is going to prosper.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's exactly where we first started mm-hmm. with this, was how do you create a fund where you would actually be an investor and go into this early stage of the proof of concept. And we vetted this very thoroughly and came to the conclusion that this first stage is really better focused on grants rather than investments mm-hmm. because it is exceedingly high risk, and that's something we need to recognize.
Right.
So for an investor, we just backed away from that. But that was my first being a true capitalist. That was that was where I headed, but we thought that there was a better way.
Chairman, Senator George, Wayne Embry, who is here today to testify, could give you a little more insight on why that would, at this stage, would be very hard to do in Oregon.
Okay, Paul Warner.
Mr. Chair, you'd ask on the comments on the spreadsheet that John prepared, and of course the answer is economists love this kind of stuff. So. But I did have a chance to go through it with John last night, and I think he's done a good job of laying out a plausible scenario. I guess the only comment I would make, and I think John alluded to this, is that there would be a wide range of variability. I think not only in terms of magnitude, and Senator George pointed out the upside magnitude would definitely be there, would be the timing, too, in terms of when these types of projects generate products, become economically viable. So there would be that issue, but I think this is a very, very plausible scenario that he's laid out.
Great. Thank you very much. I know you have burned the midnight oil on this proposal, and we appreciate it. Next panel will be Oregon State University. After their big day yesterday, we'll bring them up first and let the University of Oregon go second. Doc, take note of that. Dr. Adams.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron Adams, Dean of Engineering at Oregon State. I'm going to focus my comments on the venture fund aspect that has to do with proof of concept. I realize there's already been some conversation there. What I'm going to do is give you an example that I hope will help you better understand the power of it. And this example is based on my experience in industry. And then the second thing is to take that example related to what's happening at universities today. This is a cover of the September issue of Business Week. I didn't mean to make this an eye test for you, but just so you know. And the cover story is about Nike. And some of you may have seen that. What I'm going to talk about is the back page ad. And the back page ad is for Xerox's solid ink color printer, which turns out to also be a grown in Oregon product. And the story about that printer began in 1991 at Tektronix. At that time, I was vice president of research and development for the printer division of Tektronix. We had an idea about this product, and the idea was so powerful in terms of the market potential that we invested in taking that idea to a proof of concept. And we did that as quickly as we could.
In fact, 7 months after the idea, we presented it to the board and the senior management of Tektronix, and they invested. The result of that was a product that was introduced in 95, 1,000 new jobs for Oregonians, and eventually the sale of that division to Xerox. In fact, the office products division of Xerox is headquartered in Wilsonville, Oregon, predominantly because of the presence of the solid ink technology in that division. Now, the odds of winning at this stage are less than 1 in 10, and you need to realize that. And the story you just heard was a huge win, and we were smart and got lucky, okay? Now, and the other thing that happens at this stage is that the highest value inventions are created. And so the IP portfolio for the division around this product was really created during that first 6 or 7 months. As you've heard, this type of funding is not readily available at Oregon's universities. And there are a couple of things that happen. It's either no action is taken on ideas, or, as you heard the example given to you by Pat, there are delays in time to market. Kay Altman was in front of the Senate committee earlier, the Senate Education Committee, a few weeks ago, and she pointed out that we've been scrambling around for 12 months looking for funding to demonstrate a microfiltration device that would enable a kidney dialysis machine to be portable. So there's 12 months of time to market loss, and that has the biggest impact. In fact, it's the number one competitive advantage in innovation technologies and commercialization of technologies is time to market. The other thing that the fund would do is would provide some help for IP. And from my experience in industry, we are far from aggressive enough with protecting the inventions and intellectual property that are residing in the labs and universities. In fact, just a quick example of that, we have an invention that we've chosen to get a provisional patent on, and we'll probably wait until that provision runs out before we proceed, where we should be spending the money needed to get international patent coverage on that invention. It's spun out of Onami. It will someday enable an air conditioning system to be worn by soldiers in Iraq, those that have to wear the rubber suits. So, again, you can see the impact there. So in closing, this thing does two things for us. The University Venture Fund does two things for us. You're going to hear about the second one later. One is that it will result in new jobs for Oregonians. The story about the example of Tektronix that led to Xerox, et cetera, is a great example of that. And it will help develop Oregon's future entrepreneurs. And that's a piece that you'll hear more testimony about later on. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Arundhi Pradhan. I'm at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm the director for the Technology and Research Collaborations Office, which is the technology transfer arm for the university. I want to add to what Dr. Adams has said and give you an idea of the research and the types of technologies and the programs that we have at Oregon Health and Science University. As Dr. Adams said, most of the research that takes place at the university is funded by the federal government. It's very basic in nature. And as the previous panel alluded to, this creates in the research and development continuum, it creates something called that we refer to as the valley of death. The valley of death is that funding that takes research from concept to development. Could be something that would require animal trials. It could provide funding for prospective IP protection. It could provide molecule development for drug delivery. And it covers a wide spectrum. At Oregon Health and Science University, a year ago, we created something called the Bioscience Innovation Fund. It's about $2.5 million. This was done in conjunction with the OHSU Foundation. So we worked very closely in trying to raise this money with the foundation and allocate it to these projects. We have a mechanism set up to identify, out of all the research projects that result in inventions to our office, those that have a good likelihood of commercial success. We work closely with business schools at Portland State and with the Masters in Science and Technology program at OGI. And we provide this Valley of Death or pre-seed funding to these in the form of grants out of our internal capacity.
So, Arun, and I'm not going to try your last name, although we've chatted many times. Just on that point, so currently when you have these interesting research projects that you have with that OHSU is doing currently, you'll just go to the foundation and say, we've got something here.
No,
maybe.
We have a panel set up that evaluates these research proposals. We identify the research proposals. We ask our faculty to submit to us a proposal with a budget that we can evaluate and what the commercial endpoints for that research are going to be. Those proposals are then put in front of a committee. The committee consists of entrepreneurs and local business leaders. And then we hash it out. We fund about four or five projects a year. This is we're in the process of doing a second round. So we did four projects last year. We'll probably anticipate doing four or five this year. These projects, once they're approved, we work closely with the faculty to ensure that they start meeting the milestones that we establish. These are probably some of the sort of the crown jewels of what's going to result in a startup company for us.
But do you go and talk to the VC community at that point, or do you, I mean, you've got something in a petri dish at this point that
right.
Folks have passed that first test of, you've got the faculty research capacity there that are all saying,
mm-hmm.
Green light, or this, we want to move forward with this. Do you, but you're in the Valley of Death, as you described, and I'm sorry to get you off point here, but who currently on those four or five do you go to say, and then I guess the big question is, how would this actually new tax credit help you when you're at that stage?
So right now we provide about $100,000 to $150,000, and this does go to the Valley of Death right now. The panel consists of VCs and local entrepreneurs, so they're aware of the projects that are in the pipeline. Where this would help, even after we do provide the Valley of Death funding, where it would play, it could play, a, for example, an important role for OHSU, is once those commercialization milestones that we've established are met and we actually spin a company out. We did seven spin-out companies last year. We did, I think, five the year before that. And as alluded to earlier, a lot of companies in those first 2 years tend to flounder, and because they don't have a CEO or a CFO on the outside to provide the guidance. You have a full-time faculty member who's participating on the inside, so they're already engaged in a full-time job. So where this could play a very important role for us is to be able to provide not that Valley of Death funding, but augment that Valley of Death funding with about another $100,000 or $150,000 post-spinoff to be able to attract the CEO or an individual that would shepherd that company on the outside, be able to go to the VCs, be able to develop the business plan in conjunction with our students, provide some of the operational expenses for that company in return for you know, whatever mechanisms we choose to set up. Typically, we do a license agreement between the company and get royalties back. We have a second program, which is called the Springboard Program, which does provide about between $7,000 and $8,000 to a company to be able to go and contract with local attorneys and local financial services to try to put the building blocks, the infrastructure of the startup company in place. Anytime you're out there as a startup company and you're going to VCs, they do want to see that you have adequate legal representation as well as financial representation. And so we recognize that at the outset, and we've tried to put these building blocks together. Just as an example, last year Our startup companies raised $80 million in VC funding, but it took them a lot of time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This would shorten that process.
Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that the activity on South McAdam and the hopes of future activity, and this is obviously could be part of that puzzle in terms of...
I think it provides a very integral piece.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Embry.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Wayne Embry, managing partner of Cascadia Partners, a Portland-based venture fund. Just in front of you, you have some slides from a PowerPoint presentation that for the information I'm going to go through here. Just a way of a little bit of background. For the last 18 years, I've been a seed stage investor. Collectively, we've invested in close to 100 companies, and more than half of those companies have been based on technologies coming out of research institutions, primarily in the Northwest. So we've licensed technology from Harvard, Stanford, and some European institutions as well. The situation with respect to commercializing technology out of research institutions, particularly in North America, the last 3 years there's been a decline in startup companies being funded, being founded out of the, particularly the major research institutions, but almost all of them. And there's a couple of reasons for this. The first one is that there's been a conscious decision on the part of a lot of technology transfer professionals to try and improve the quality of the entities that are being spun out. So add more to the technology. Some universities are actually starting to hire entrepreneurs in residence to increase the likelihood that those ventures will succeed. The other more important and more compounding problem has been a decrease in available capital for early stage companies. It sounds odd given the amount of money that I'm sure everybody hears is available in the venture capital community. So it's not a shortage of money, it's how it's allocated. The other issue is that, and this has been proven empirically, startup companies based on university technology are disproportionately successful compared to other startups. So this is something we found also in our experience and our investments and why we continue to look to universities for opportunities. And then cities with large patent and science and engineering capacity have demonstrated an increased innovation commercialization capacity. However, as you've been hearing, money is necessary to be able to anchor those wealth-creating opportunities. On the next page, you'll see a slide entitled Evolution of Private Equity. In spite of everything that happened and all the noise that happened during the dot-com bubble, the amount of available capital going to seed, startup, and early-stage companies was on a steady decline and has been for the last 9 years.
Huh.
And this is there are a bunch of institutional reasons for this, but as more money has been forced into the venture capital market, the venture capital funds have gone to later-stage businesses that require larger amounts of money as opposed to investing early in the businesses.
Is that just all based on risk?
It's actually based on just sheer dollars. So if you're managing a $300 million venture capital fund, it's very difficult to make a $100,000 investment.
Hmm.
So the approach has really been one of looking for opportunities that will take down, you know, $10, $20, $30 million as opposed to actually starting with a nascent idea and building a company around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
Is it logical to assume then if we can move the level of perfection of the technology to the next level that, in fact, the negotiations for percentages of ownership and stuff might actually improve for return to the university system? And
Mr. Chair, Senator George, in theory, the answer to that is yes. What you certainly do is you increase the likelihood that business will be successful. The next slide kind of gives you an idea what the funnel looks like in North America for research and investment in the research universities and major hospitals. It's about $30 billion a year, about $23 billion from the federal government, and the remainder coming from other sources. It results in about 15,000 invention disclosures, about 6,000 patent applications, and about 4,000 issued patents. Now, keeping in mind that the backlog at the Patent and Trademark Office is 4 to 5 years right now in certain disciplines. So seeing this in terms of numbers of patents issued in any one given year, that could be technology that was disclosed many years prior. and roughly 4,000 licenses that on an annual basis result in 350 to about 700 viable startups. The reason the spread is so large is it's estimated inside the profession of technology commercialization that up to half of the good ideas go out the back door. It's particularly difficult to get your arms around intellectual property relating just to computer code that has not been patented. So in many cases, these companies are formed without knowledge of the technology commercialization office. And in some cases, it's based on technology that's been waived, and it may not actually even be counted in the actual data. But this 350 to 700 firms, last year, the formal venture capital community only invested in 120 new startup companies. So, again, it's looking at these companies and basing their viability on whether or not a venture capital fund invests in them is actually not a good measure as to whether or not they're a good idea. In terms of what this looks like across the nation and over historically, since 1980, there have been about 3,400 spinouts from the research institutions in North America. 70% of those companies are still in business. So, again, it goes back to that notion that, that technologies which drive startup companies that come out of research institutions are disproportionately more successful.
Do you know, Mr. Embry, out of that 3,400, this would be, I'm sure, just kind of a ballpark figure, what percentage come from the major research institutions, maybe the big 20 that we know of? Do you have, Arun, I don't...
I can't pull that out of the top of my head, but I know the startup activity in universities varies. I don't think it has necessarily anything to do with the size. It just depends on which university is more proactive in startup formation. MIT and Stanford definitely are, but Johns Hopkins is not, for example. But
we just hear the stories from, you know, if you're on the West Coast, Stanford, and
right.
Your initial thought is that a good deal of the West Coast activity is actually occurring.
Yeah, Senator Decker, in comparison, Stanford had 7 spin-out companies last year.
Last year.
So it was on par with what OHSU had. Actually, the most efficient university in Canada for spin-outs, and several of the Canadian institutions are far more aggressive than those in the U.S., is a university, Simon Fraser, in Burnaby, British Columbia. And their research budget is less than $50 million annually. But they're extremely aggressive in looking for opportunities which can be commercialized and then following up on those.
Well, that's really good news for us, frankly, that targeted and specific focus can achieve pretty good results.
Yes.
At OHSU, obviously, it's occurring.
And you know, and you see on this chart that in the time period from 1980 till about the mid-90s, University of California system only had a total of 170 spinouts, and that's a massive organization. And I think what's important is that the failure rate was less than 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other item there is that the startups were much more likely to honor the terms of a license agreement and pay the royalties as opposed to a large licensee. And so that also bodes well from the perspective of the institutions in terms of, you're going back to Senator George's question, can you actually earn a return from this?
Uh-huh.
The next slide shows you MIT's experience in a snapshot. In that 16-year period, there are 2,300 disclosures, 1,400 patents, 134 spin-out companies, of which 120 were still operating at the time that this study was done in early 2000 timeframe, and there were 33 initial public offerings. So they were able to develop very strong companies, very powerful. Going back to your previous question, the technologies that come out of the major, well-recognized research institutions tend to be favored over other institutions, mainly because there is a pedigree associated with that. But that in itself is not a guarantee of success.
Hmm.
On the next page, again, this is just part of the discussion that related to this piece of legislation and what are the opportunities for furthering the development. The prototype development funds are extremely important. And then on the final slide, we've worked extensively with the University of British Columbia over the last 10 years. And over that time period, they've had a prototype development program that's been about $3 million in size. And it's leveraged over $400 million in equity into spin-out companies. And they're taking the same approach that I described earlier. They are actually trying to do fewer spin-outs, make sure that they're more robust. They recently brought on board the very first CEO from the first spin-out that was ever done at the University of British Columbia, and he's now an entrepreneur in residence there. And this money came primarily from the federal government and some provincial money years ago as just a direct contribution to the Tech Transfer Office. And then the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Corporation, which was created in 1985 by the Assembly, made R&D investments as its initial investments in companies such as AVI Biopharma, which was founded on technology coming out of Oregon State, Electronic Power Conditioning, which was also founded on technology out of Oregon State and was the basis for the Power Lab that's now at Oregon State, Northwest Neurologic and Virogenomics from Oregon Health Sciences, and Templex Technologies out of the U of O, which is now owned by Intel. To give you an idea of how important this also is, Mark Stevens, who's a Bay Area venture capitalist and a graduate from UCLA, recently gave over $20 million to the university for the engineering program with a stipulation that there be a very heavy emphasis on technology commercialization as part of that grant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Embry. Questions for the panel? How do you think it would be viewed? One of the issues that we're sorting through right now is direct appropriation versus a tax credit, this new idea that's been brought forward. And how do you think it would be viewed, I guess, in the circles that you roam, if Oregon did enact this new tax credit but didn't make a direct appropriation in terms of helping with the problems that Arun and Ron Adams described?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think most people in the venture community generally recognize that it is just, again, most of these investments for the kinds of investing that they do is far too early and too time-consuming. So from the perspective of anything that can be done that clears up some of those nagging questions about viability and commercial opportunity will be viewed as a benefit to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And no, I guess one path or the other, it's just any path is a good path. That's what I hear you saying.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time and effort. Newly recruited to the University of Oregon from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Jim Bean and Mason Adir and Jim Gorla.
Oh, no, that's John. He's ours.
Oh, we've got him. Okay, good. I was going to mispronounce his name. Welcome to Oregon.
Thank you, Chairman Deckert and the committee. For the record, my name is James Bean, Dean of the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon. Today I will be trying to also speak for my friends, Dean Eileen Kleinsorge at the College of Business at Oregon State University and Dean Scott Dawson of the School of Business Administration at Portland State University, and trying to represent some of the expertise we have in the state in entrepreneurship education. This is important to filling the valley of death we've heard about, because when a laboratory has developed an exciting technology, it often is not associated with a particular market opportunity. And the entrepreneurship personnel and programs across the state provide the programs and the people to develop the business plans, develop the market opportunities, attach the legal expertise to protect the intellectual property, to move to a concept that a venture capitalist or angel funder might be more interested in taking forward. Independently, the three major business schools have developed excellent entrepreneurship programs, not redundant, overlapping each other, but really quite different from each other and quite complementary, because each of their missions is quite different. At Portland State University, for each of them, I will mention only one of the many activities they're doing. At Portland State University, the Lab to Market program is co-directed by the School of Business Administration and the College of Liberal Arts and the Sciences. It's attained a $600,000 NSF grant to help commercialize 12 particular technologies. It involves a number of faculty and students and hopes to move these technologies into the PSU accelerator so that it can begin by creating high-wage jobs and strengthening Oregon's innovation economy. This program has 25 partners, including OHSU, OSU, and the University of Oregon. And it also puts on workshops for technologists out in companies or in universities to help them begin to think managerially about what's necessary to take these technologies to a commercial venture. This may be the strongest faculty involvement program of any of those we have in the state. At Oregon State, the Austin Entrepreneurship Center that is housed in Weatherford Hall is a joint venture between the College of Business, the College of Engineering, and the University Housing and Dining. It provides an opportunity for engineers and business professionals, both students and working professionals, to live in an intensive entrepreneurship environment. The building includes dormitory rooms, classrooms, faculty offices, executive rooms, incubator space, and it's the place in the state that you're most likely to hear at 2 o'clock in the morning, "Get up, I have an idea." This is the largest and most complete facility of this type in the area of entrepreneurship in the United States and is really a crown jewel of the OUS system. At the University of Oregon, in the Lundquist Center for Entrepreneurship, which is the oldest of these centers, began in 1988, was ranked recently by U.S. News as 16th out of 800 entrepreneurship centers in the United States. One of its prime activities is called the Technology Entrepreneur Program, where teams of business students, law students, and science students look for technologies in either the U of O laboratories or the laboratories of Pacific Northwest National Labs. They take these technologies, analyze their intellectual property protection, analyze market opportunities, and develop a business plan to move forward. Out of last summer's program of three teams, two of them are moving forward to start businesses at this time. Their business plans have been competing internationally in business. There are about 30 business plan competitions for universities around the world. Two teams have three wins, 2 seconds, and an honorable mention in the competition so far this year, which is truly a dominating performance by Oregon teams as far away from Thailand to Cincinnati. The two teams, Perpetua and Clean Smart, have attracted attention. One of them of the largest corporate VC fund in the world, the other one of a large angel investor, and are currently in discussions of moving forward to that next stage beyond the Valley of Death. Mason Adair, who will testify in a second, is a student on one of those teams, will give you a firsthand account of the activities. What this bill would mean for these programs is the ability to increase the models that have already been developed with excellence to provide the scale that can truly impact the Oregon economy. For example, the three projects that we did in the Technology Entrepreneur Program last summer, we would like to, over several years, expand to 20 or 25 projects looking at different technologies, not only from U of O, but at the other schools in the state and other corporations as well. Currently, the three major business schools are in advanced negotiation to forming a business institute that would be housed in Portland that would be built initially on the Oregon Executive MBA program, which the three currently partner in and is 20 years old and been quite successful. The expansions we intend are to do short course executive education, which is a market that really needs play in the Oregon economy, but also a one-stop commercialization center where there would be staff who would understand all of these programs at the different schools, as well as invite the involvement of private schools and other programs in the state, so that someone who had an idea, whether it's faculty at one of the universities or in a potential startup company, would have some place to come and begin to talk with someone who might say, "This is a wonderful project give to the Weatherford School for a year to work on," or, "This is a project that a TEP team could run with." And at the same time, then be able to start mixing the organization. So we might have University of Oregon faculty working on lab-to-market projects, OSU engineers on technology entrepreneur teams, and PSU business students living in Weatherford working on the projects there. That's the vision that we have for how we want to move forward.
Mr. Bean?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We are just right up against the clock, but I think, I mean, the thing, when I'm reading your testimony, it mentioned the Wolverine Fund, mm-hmm. which to me is something obviously you know a little bit about coming from the University of Michigan. To me, that is exactly where we would hope to get. If this advances
because it's actually was mentioned earlier today and we hear it a lot, is marrying the good research with your graduates, with folks who understand management, marketing, and the ability to actually run a company. And so that is, to be just really frank, is the biggest, if you see this as helpful to actually replicating the successes of the Wolverine Fund, because I think Oregon, I don't know your assessment, but I think Oregon is badly in need of that type of activity, where there seems to be a lot of ideas germinating, and just building the right team around those ideas is one of our challenges.
Senator Deckard, thank you. One of the advantages that Michigan has is pure size. They were able to fund the Wolverine Fund internally. It's a $4 billion operation. The schools in Oregon are much smaller and need to work together and with the help of this bill to accomplish the same thing that the Wolverine Fund's been able to do. So, yes, I do see it as a critical part of that development.
Well, I think we'd be interested to, I will speak for myself, any other ways that we can be helpful. To me, that just seems the economy benefits in such a large degree. So I think we'll want to talk to you more about other things Oregon might be able to do, and this might be one step in that direction to replicate your success in Michigan. Other questions for Mr. Adair?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mace Adair. I'm an MBA student from the University of Oregon, and I'd just like to give an anecdotal glimpse of what we've been talking about here today as far as the commercialization process based on my own experiences in developing a business plan and a venture from the University of Oregon. Just to give a glimpse of the process of selecting a technology, as Dr. Breen had talked about previously, this summer my teammates met with representatives from Pacific Northwest National Laboratories as well as representatives from the biosciences department at the University of Oregon to review and discuss the commercialization potential of technologies from both of these institutions. And with the help from representatives from both of these organizations, my team and other team members of other teams worked with these representatives to research these technologies and look for the specific applications where these technologies could be carried into the market and commercialized. And then after this process, after the initial research step, this moved into a course that was held in the fall where team members would assemble a go-to-market team consisting of marketing, finance, and also sales and other business-related areas of expertise and students that could fill these roles. We built a go-to-market team and received guidance from the faculty to build out a business plan, which culminated in a business plan competition last winter. Our team did very well. We won this one. And after that, we received further support throughout the winter quarter from our faculty and connections in the entrepreneurial community, going out and talking to firms like Preston Gates and Ellis, as well as Intel Capital, for example, that would help us refine our plan. And this vetting process really was instrumental in our successes that Dr. Breen had talked about previously. 3 weeks ago, we competed against 20 universities in Asia at the Asia Moot Corp competition in Bangkok, and we did very well, beating 18 of these 20 teams, taking a first runner-up position. And really, one thing I would like to mention about this opportunity is it was really a one-time, a great opportunity for all of our students. And it was really up in the air for a while because it was going to be a function of whether we could get this one-time gift from a friend of the center who donated a large sum of money to allow a team of four to go over to Bangkok and compete in this competition. So naturally, this was a very unique and rewarding opportunity for all of us to be able to do this, interacting with different cultures, meeting with VCs, not only from a Western perspective, but also from an Asian perspective, that would give us the ability to sell what our really truly global product would be into a variety of markets. And also one thing to be clear about is we couldn't go through all of this business, this process, if it weren't a potentially a viable business. This is not just an academic exercise. So we were structured as an LLC. We'll be incorporating as an S-Corp once we start talking to VCs. But also it's important that we, as students, would be taking an equity stake in the company, and also to talk about the structure of how the deals would work with the labs of the universities. Just to give an example, we were talking to Pacific Northwest National Laboratories in doing either an equity stake or a licensing fee, a flat fee or a percentage basis that the lab would receive upon the launch of our venture and based on our revenue. So that's the type of funding that would go back to whatever source the technology came from. And then finally, just to give a summary of the results that we as students have received through the process, I mean, we've really, by talking to the venture capital firms, the law firms, the five students on our team have developed a great network of contacts throughout the business community. So regardless of what we do with the venture or with our careers, we have a base of contacts here, which will definitely help us going forward. And then through the business plan competitions alone, we've raised over $18,000 in seed funding for our venture. The competition have also put us in contacts with potential customers and partners in the U.S. and Asia as a result of our competition. And certainly, we've also identified an exciting market space, validation of our own abilities to conceive a business plan from scratch, knowledge of the venture creation process, and also firsthand experience in also developing this professional network that would allow us all to do a variety of things within the entrepreneurial community here in Oregon.
Thank you. Congratulations on
Thank you.
Your success. It's good to hear because it addresses exactly the issue that I think OHSU and OSU was talking about in terms of adding your skills to the research skills that we have. Questions for this panel? Dr. Bean, just one, and yes and no is kind of unfair given that you've only been here a short period of time, but do you feel that the donors that you've talked to and the folks that are invested in your work at the School of Business at U of O would utilize this tax credit? Is it something you could talk to them about and talk to them about the work that Mr. Adair was doing, and they'd actually want to put down some of their capital as an investment?
Yes, Chair Deckard, thank you. I think definitely that is a yes. We've been talking to many people as part of our current campaign, and this is an issue that has caused excitement with many of them. The tax credits give our development people, one of whom is sitting over here, a tremendous tool to work with in these discussions, and so I believe it would be quite successful.
Thank you. Thank you. Ralph Groner is our last. Thank you very much. I appreciate taking the time. Ralph is here to answer all technical questions, so we kind of waited on those, and for all the real ins and outs and difficult questions, let's put those to Mr. Groner.
I advise you on this subject.
Ralph Groner, I won't take your time. You're doing the session. I have a handout. I'm with AFSCME, and I appreciate the opportunity to support this wonderful bill. I would ask that you have the economic development team from OHSU that did a presentation yesterday in front of the House Economic Development Committee regarding the riverfront development and would answer more specifically than I've heard today just exactly how these dollars would be used. I'd just like to say on behalf of OHSU and my 5,000 members and my largest local in Oregon of 170 of them that we have grown we now have 42,000 jobs, but one of the things you'll see on the chart that I'm getting is we will create 6,000 new jobs over the next few years. We currently provide $2.7 billion in economic activity, and using a conservative multiplier, you'll see that for every dollar received by OHSU, $27 comes back in gifts, contracts, etc., and service funds for every dollar, in this case the state, but it wouldn't matter if it were the state or this fund. They are primed and ready to use these funds to continue the growth. Right now we bring in $74 million to the general fund, a biennium in income taxes, not adding the 5,500 construction jobs currently going on at OHSU. I've currently asked for those figures, but that brings into the general fund. It's currently probably one of the largest economic development engines putting funds into the general fund. That's my bottom line. We would appreciate continuing to grow jobs so that we have money for our schools, human services, and public safety. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, Ralph, thank you for joining the chorus because you're a different voice that says we got to do things to spur the economy and actually increase that general fund that we're watching. Questions for Mr. Groner? Thank you very much. So we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 853. Senator Morse, we're going to put this back up. If someone from the foundations, that's the one that I didn't hear from today, if I could talk to someone from the foundations between now and tomorrow, that'd be terrific. committee we are not going to get to, but we have them up for tomorrow, our reserve fund ideas. So we'll bring back the two. Are they up tomorrow, the two reserve funds?
Work session. Mm-hmm.
So we'll bring back 841 and what's...
SJR 19.
SJR 19 for tomorrow to consider those. Thank you for coming to the Capitol today, for traveling a distance. We really appreciate your time and effort, and we'll have this issue back before us tomorrow.
Are we done?
Adjourn the Senate Rep.
We're done.